This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. Welcome everybody to the Safina Society, nothing but facts, live stream. Suddenly, it's literally like winter. It's freezing out. It's really cold. I always start off with the weather report in New Jersey. Whole world's going to know the weather report in New Jersey, but suddenly it's really cold. We're starting off today, we're talking politics today again. And we're going to start off with this clip from Trump. Why isn't this not playing?
I will sign a new executive order instructing every federal agency to cease all programs that promote the concept of sex and gender transition at any age. I will then ask Congress to permanently stop federal taxpayer dollars from being used to promote or pay for these procedures. The Department of Justice will investigate Big Pharma and the big hospital networks to determine whether they have deliberately covered up horrific long-term side effects of sex transitions in order to get rich at the expense of vulnerable patients. We will promote positive education about the nuclear family, the roles of mothers and fathers, and celebrating rather than erasing the things that make men and women different and unique. I will ask Congress to pass a bill establishing that the only genders recognized by the United States government are male and female, and they are assigned at birth.
All right, there you have it. Well, I guess I'm with that, right? Well, I'm totally with that. We have a special guest today. He's really smart, and he named his podcast The Thinking Muslim. His name is Muhammad Jalal. He's a very intelligent interviewer, and he has his own opinions of his own now, and they're usually always backed with evidence. So let's have him on, Muhammad Jalal out of England. And it's late at night now in England. It's now 9 p.m. or so, right?
Actually, it's 7:30, but it's as cold here today as it is in New Jersey, I think. But just thank you very much for your kind introduction.
It's great to have you on. I remember your live stream coming out, your podcast coming about during COVID, I think. You just started up, maybe around COVID, maybe before COVID. Everything in our world is BC or AC, right?
That's right.
Or DC during COVID.
During COVID.
But anyway, that's not what's important. What's important is the content of your live stream and your podcast are very thought-provoking. Let's kick it off with what you just heard from Trump.
Yeah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for inviting me, Dr. Shadi.
And I'm my pleasure.
I really enjoy your shows, and alhamdulillah, I've been following your podcasts and your conversations for a very long time. So it's really a pleasure to be on your platform. So I think it's really interesting to see what Donald Trump is trying to do. And of course, Donald Trump is going to be a transformational president. This is, of course, his second term. And so the risk of having to fight another election is not there. I mean, he's not going to be able to change the constitution and fight for a third term. And so that weight of responsibility or that weight to fight another election is no longer present. And it's very clear to me that Donald Trump this time round, partly because he has got you know, Congress, he's got the House of Representatives, he's got a majority, of course, not an overall majority, but a majority in the Senate. He's got the Supreme Court. He won the popular vote. He is in a very strong position. Actually, one of the most, I suspect, you know, one of the strongest positions a president has found themselves in a very long time. Because, of course, the way your system works in America is that the checks and balances, the Supreme Court, Congress, these work to restrain the appetites of a president. Well, we don't have very many of those restraints now for Donald Trump. So Donald Trump, in terms of his ideology, and I know we want to talk about that, wants to transform the United States. Now, of course, a lot of that could be bluster and a lot of that could just be hot air. And of course, like all politicians, he is he has to respond to not just the population and you know, people who are very much, I think, on his side when it comes to some of these social issues. But he also has to respond to big money, and big money will play a part. And of course, he's going to have to respond to Zionists in his administration. So that is also something to be aware of. But I think Donald Trump is going to try to change America in his own image. And that will have a great impact on America's economy. It'll have an impact on America's foreign policy. And certainly, I think these social issues, these wedge issues, these cultural matters, Donald Trump is going to make sure that he sets a very clear, he sets clear blue water between himself and the Democrats. Remember, a lot of the commentators have argued that one of the reasons why Kamala Harris lost is because historically, at least, I know not during the election campaign, but historically, she has been socially very liberal on some of these matters, right? So it's no harm to him to remind the electorate that Kamala Harris and the Democrats are pursuing these social agendas that most people cannot relate to. And it's not, you know, and you know, one last point to make there is, I think the Republicans, Donald Trump, has successfully argued that the Democrats today are not the party of the working classes. They're not the party of the rural America as they used to be in past days. If we think about Kennedy's era and you think about sort of post-war, but the Democrats today are very much the urban elites, and they cater for the tastes of the urban elites. And a lot of those urban elites are ridiculed, I suspect, by large swathes of Americans who find their drama to be pretty ridiculous, right? So I can imagine for Trump, it's not a bad thing at this moment to remind people why he was seen to be the sensible candidate. And, you know, Donald Trump, from where I'm standing, doesn't sound very sensible, but, you know, in relation to some of these extremities of the Democrats, probably is.
It's exactly how you describe the Democrats, as an arrogant urban elite that come out of the universities and the media. New York, Boston, and San Francisco are their hubs, possibly parts of Chicago, but no one can relate to them anymore. Their character, their arrogant, snobby attitude, but also, more importantly, is their insane ideas. But I could foresee as well, eventually, you know, the ayah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسَ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضِ. If it was not for Allah using one group of people to push off another group of people, the whole earth would be corrupted. So there is a, when the righteous, when the believers, notice he says an-nas in this verse, people. That means they may be good or bad, but they're, whether accidentally, whether otherwise, they're knocking off a certain agenda. And that, I think a couple years ago, really people felt like enough is enough with these, with the social movement that's gone so crazy and so insane, and no one's ever seen this stuff before. And it really bothered people. And that's really where the Democrats lost. And maybe you could say that the genocide definitely pushed them over. It tipped them over, but people were really getting fed up with the Democrats because of their complete favoritism to this insane agenda. And that's really where they're totally lost touch. I mean, if you look at the map of, hey, Omar, pull that map up of what the election looked like. It's literally almost an entirely red map. And there's only literal sparks of, not that one, go by county. Omar, get the one that's by county, right? The one by county is insane. It's like almost all red.
Hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess that's the one. Yeah. So anyway, Omar's going to pull it up, but the Democrats, it's not just the Republicans' action. It's also the Democrats shooting themselves in the foot and not realizing that most people still don't want their kids exposed to this stuff.
Yeah.
And when are they going to get it through their head? I think it's too late. It's too late. They're never going to move off those positions. And they're a party that I think they're going to need some serious reform, because they really don't get it. And there's no way they're moving off of their progressive agenda on moral issues. So let's talk about this specific injunction from Trump, or what he wants to do. What is the status in England right now? We have a lot of viewers out of England. In fact, most of our viewers are out of England who are live, because we're in the evening there. Tell us, in England, what is the law now regarding gender and transgender and everything?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some pushback here as well in terms of politicians. I mean, the equivalent of the Democrats in Britain, of course, the Labour Party here. And for a while, the Labour Party pursued a progressive agenda. In fact, even the Conservatives, who were the equivalent, of course, of the Republicans, they pursued a very socially progressive agenda. Because the Conservatives, for a while under David Cameron, if you remember him as Prime Minister, they realized that they were losing touch with the electorate. And one of the ways by which he exposed himself to a broader electorate was to move on some of these progressive issues. It was Theresa May, who was Prime Minister, who at one point wanted to introduce self-ID without medical certification. So it was just self-identification without the limitations that may come from seeking medical advice. She didn't successfully get that passed. In fact, she never finally sought to do so, because she realized there would be a backlash from her own party. But since then, both political parties have moved in a very conservative direction, even the Labour Party. So Keir Starmer, who's the Prime Minister today of the Labour Party, he would never talk about these progressive issues. And because he knows that his party were out of sync with the population. So we still have, if you ask about the law, and I'm not so conversant in all the details of the law about this, but, you know, gender reassignment surgery is legal, of course, in the UK, but it requires a lot of medical oversight. Ironically, by the way, it was the Scottish National Party in Scotland who tried to dilute that in Scotland, because health policy is the purview of the Scottish government. And it was Hamza Yousaf, believe it or not, who was the First Minister of Scotland, who fought very hard to introduce self-identification for trans individuals. He actually even fought a case at the UK Supreme Court to try to overturn a veto by the central government that didn't allow him to do so. And subhanAllah, I mean, it's a sad place for a Muslim politician to be. So I suppose I know a lot of your health policy is decentralized and it's down to individual states. But in the UK, at least, movement hasn't really been made in that direction, simply because the electorate just wouldn't have it. I mean, the last election, for example, the Labour Party successfully argued that they would not be entertaining any of these matters or any of these issues as part of their policy agenda.
What about the government? Does the government in the UK recognize different genders on their official forms, their census, etc.?
Yes, they do, but not on. So it's slightly technical. You can't change, as I understand it, you can't change your original documentation. But what you can do is get replacement documentation that reflect your new assignment, your new gender assignment. But that can only be after a medical procedure. And so one needs to go down that pathway before doing so. What Hamza Yusuf wanted to introduce is he wanted to remove the necessity effectively of doing that. And so one could self-ID. Again, I think some states in America allow self-ID. I'm not sure if I'm right or wrong about that. It's not as progressed or progressive as it is in the United States.
Yeah, honestly, just hearing government officials talk about that, I think it's important, you know, for people to hear. They want to hear that, right? They just want to hear it from a government perspective, or from someone in government. Let's talk about your research. You're writing about Trump's ideology. My first question: does Trump have a fixed ideology? If you ask me, it seems to be really general, basic law and order, old-fashioned men and women, right? That's what it seems to be, more of a nostalgia. So what are you coming across?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. And in fact, I had a conversation with Sami Hamdi about this yesterday. He's back in the UK, and he spends more time in America, I think, at this moment than in the UK. And we were talking about whether Trump has a fixed ideology, whether he's just everything to everyone, or as someone once said, Trump is as good as his last conversation. So if you meet Trump before he gives a speech, he potentially will echo your voice because you're the last person he spoke to. And so that indicates a president who really doesn't have any fixed positions. I disagree with that. I think certainly his personality is like that. You know, he is someone who moves with the wind, but I think he does have some fixed positions, especially on economic and foreign policy. And I think these fixed positions actually are out of sync with the American consensus. So since the Second World War, liberal America, when I mean liberal America, I don't just mean the Democrats, I mean Republicans as well here. Liberal America has established this thinking about ordering the world according to America's footprint. And so they established what became known as the liberal world order. And the idea was that America would be at the center of this global tapestry of states. And America, through NATO and through its economic alliances and through its very various international institutions, would be able to establish a world in its own image, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's what some call a globalist agenda, you know, a world where America is at the center and America has hundreds of U.S. bases around the world, and it manages to keep the peace in inverted commas through its global strength and just its sheer weight of military prowess. Now, that America has been under a lot of scrutiny, and I think it started really during the war on terror and its failed operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then just the amount of the burden that America's military has on American taxpayers and how that has impacted ordinary Americans. I remember in 2016, when Donald Trump was first fighting elections, he was questioned about his foreign policy. And he said something quite instructive. He said, we've spent $4 trillion in the Middle East. If we had kept that money at home, we could have rebuilt America three times over. And I suppose the point he was making was this America first ideology, this idea that globalism, America's position in the world, America's military alliances, America's requirement to project power, all of that has been at the expense of American people and America's taxpayers and ordinary Americans. I mean, you know, liberal American, I mean liberal American in terms of Democrats now, liberal America scoffs at the country the countryside, you know, the Bible Belt, the Rust Belt Americans, you know, those Americans who have different values to them. But of course, these Americans, of course, have suffered as a result of their industries being exported to China and Singapore and to Malaysia and to elsewhere. And, you know, workers who would work in Detroit car factories for many generations suddenly found themselves without job and without occupation. And they found themselves, you know, consumed by alcoholism and drugs and the rest of it. So you've had this social breakdown in many of these Rust Belt cities and towns. Mm-hmm. Now, I think what Donald Trump stands for, back to your question, is he stands for a type of economic and global policy that concerns themselves with America first and not with these global entanglements, because these global entanglements have harmed America, right? And I think that's a coherent philosophy. I have to say it's out of sync with large swathes of American consensus thinking. And you saw that in the last, in the first Trump presidency. Trump, of course, did not have control over the Republicans as he has now. And so he had to sort of outweigh the different types of Republicans and bring them into his cabinet. And so he got Jim Mattis and he got McMaster and he got, you know, all of these guys who were very globalist. The neocons were in his cabinet. And the idea was that he could sort of have a balance of people within his cabinet. Some of them reflected his very nationalist, white nativist, you can say, worldview, and others reflected a more globalist position. And of course, these people then worked against him. They moderated his foreign policy and his economic positions. They tried to hold him back on mm-hmm. some issues. Well, I think this is going to be a Donald Trump who's unrestrained, a Trump who is able to project his philosophy upon the country and change that country. And I think that's a philosophy. I mean, you know, I think that's an ideology. Okay, fine, it's not a thick ideology. Maybe there are things he's still going to have to outweigh some tensions within the Republican Party and balance that out. But I think he does believe in something. I think it's, in a way, it's a democratic ruse to say this man is just a vacuous nobody. I don't think that's the case, right?
I don't think that's the case. And America First is, as you say, an ideology. But I would also say that, is it such a radical one? Isn't every country, shouldn't every individual has to save his own life and rectify himself before he rectifies others? Then he's got to take care of his household before he worries about somebody else. Like, the nearer is more important than the further. Isn't it a common sense ideology for every nation, if we were to even just accept the status quo of the nation states that we have? Wouldn't every country care about itself first?
Well, exactly. And that is the case for normal states. But in the words of Robert Kagan, who wrote a really good book. I mean, Robert Kagan is the neocon, but turned liberal. But he wrote a really good book, The World America Made. It's a slim volume, and I would advise your viewers to read it, because I think it's a really good read. He talked about America's liberal world order being in its enlightened self-interest. And so, of course, by expanding your military and economic weight around the world and projecting your power in all corners of the world, the idea really is that you bring the coffers home. You bring, like the British Empire vowed, where the gold and the riches of India came back to Britain. Mm-hmm. America will reap those sorts of rewards. So ultimately, his argument was and is that America's global empire is there to serve its own self-interest. At the end of the day, America's become rich on the back of you know, exploitation of other countries around the world, and the back of the dollar dominance, and on the back of the manner in which America is able to interfere in every affair in every place in the world, right? Now, Donald Trump's point is, well, fine, maybe, just maybe, we were successful for a while using that strategy, but for a long time, that's failed us, because that's failed America in general. I mean, Donald Trump made a very interesting point. And again, I hate to say Donald Trump is, you know, is a clever guy here, but he made a very interesting point, which I actually believe, I think it's true. he said something about China. He said that in the 2000s, we allowed China to become a member of the World Trade Organization, right? And Bill Clinton at the time did so. It was end of the 1990s, early 2000s. I think it was just about when he was leaving presidency, but he paved the way, and it was George Bush Jr. who finally consolidated that. So it was a consensus between the two parties. They lowered the standards to allow China to be part of the World Trade Organization. Now, if you're part of the WTO, that gives you preferential trading rights with every other member of the WTO, right? It was a really radical move, but Clinton and Bush at the time had in their mind this sort of really ridiculous idea that if China trades like a capitalist country, mm-hmm. China is going to become a democracy like us, and China will soon become a liberal-minded democracy like us, right? Mm-hmm. And so the gateway into becoming, you know, a cappuccino drinking New Yorker, mm-hmm. If you live in Beijing, is to first become a capitalist country, and we're going to make them capitalist and rich, and then they're going to become like us. Actually, what happened was completely the opposite. Mm. China has become a stronger authoritarian state, and it's using its riches now to build its military. And China now, at least regionally, if not in many corners of the world, can compete with America on a military basis, on a like-by-like military basis, right? And
why,
so,
if I can interrupt 1 second, why would the Americans care about the Chinese people becoming more liberal?
Because there is this philosophy, and it goes back right to Immanuel Kant. There is this philosophy that when countries become liberal and become democracies, they're not going to go to war with one another. It was what Francis Fukuyama said. When you have two countries that are democracies, Britain and France are not going to go to war with one another because they look and feel the same. They're both liberal countries, right? Mm-hmm. You know, America is not going to go to war with Canada because these are liberal countries, whereas America could go to war with China or North Korea because mm-hmm. one is a dictatorship and one is a liberal democracy. So they've got this philosophy, and it's a crazy philosophy, by the way. It makes very little sense in reality. But a philosophy argues, I mean, it was Thomas Friedman, the even more ridiculous writer for the New York Times, who wrote in 1991, I think it was, he developed this theory called the Golden Arches theory mm-hmm. of world peace. And the argument was that if a country has a McDonald's in it, mm-hmm. that country is never going to go to war with another country that has a McDonald's in it. Mm-hmm. Because McDonald's represents capitalism, a free market capitalism, mm-hmm. but it also represents a type of liberal economy and a liberal society, because it's young urban elites that go to McDonald's and, you know, hang out there and whatever. And so it represents a type of attitude, and that attitude yeah. would mean that you never go to war with one another, right? And so if you can convert, and it's a conversion, I mean, it's a religious conversion, but if you can convert lots of Chinese people into it, to become good capitalists and good liberals, then you make them like us, but also you make them less threatening to us. Right. Mm-hmm. So in effect, what they wanted to do is make China into another Japan or Germany. If you remember, mm-hmm. Germany and Japan after the Second World War were completely reoriented into these liberal democracies they are today. And that's what they wanted for China. And by the way, that's what George W. Bush wanted for the Muslim world when he went to war
yeah.
in Iraq and Afghanistan.
OK, so, yeah, I mean, I guess I get the idea that if people all become liberal democracies, they won't fight each other. But I mean, if we just take it to its logical extension real quick, if the entire world became liberal democracies, it's not fathomable that there is going to be a world without war, right? So, but I do get the idea.
They would cite, Dr. Chai, I mean, sorry to cut you, they would cite, for example, the European Union. So the European Union is the sort of like premium liberal institution. And these mm-hmm. are 27 countries that come together. And by the way, to become a member of the EU, you've got to be a liberal democracy in a capitalist country, right?
Yeah.
You've got to adopt these. It's what they're called the Copenhagen criteria. You've got to adopt these sort of thick values. And so, you know, historically, Poland and France did not see eye to eye because Poland was a communist country and France was a capitalist country.
Yeah.
But today, you know, you can't foresee a war between Poland and France. At least that's what they argue. And so you've now got this happy union of Europeans mm-hmm. Who live in this family of states. And if they have disputes, the disputes are very low level and not high level. That's the argument. That's the liberal dream that Immanuel Kant imagined, you know, back in the sort of 18th century.
Yeah, and it's essentially any group of people that basically is saying that any group of people who agree won't go to war. Boil it down to a six-year-old level, right? If we like each other, we won't go to war. If we agree on stuff, right? That's the basic summary of it. And now, when it comes to America First, I look at two things. I get it that you go out all around the world and you got your ships everywhere, but I only get that, and I think most people would agree, if the people are seeing the results of it. So if you ever watched documentaries about England when they had their empire, you had a guy who received a monthly check for serving in the military, and he had a home that was massive, right? You got a massive, these are like manors, they named the home. He hardly works anymore. And I'm like, he just gets a salary just like from retiring as a military man. So he can understand why the military is out and about. But once that stops, then you have a problem. You can't tell your family, I'm working 12 hours a day. I'm out of the house 18 hours a day, but there's no money in the bank account. It doesn't add up. No one's going to accept it, right? So you're either home or you're making money for us. Yeah. We're seeing here that very slowly, infrastructure in other nations is surpassing our infrastructure, and problems are mounting, dissatisfaction's mounting. So that's where it brings about the question, where is all the benefit, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you went and looted natural gas from Afghanistan. So why is our gas price high then, right? Things like that. Those are the questions people are going to ask.
Well, absolutely, and that's because capitalism it produces such an inequality in society. Those benefits go to the very top, and so the elites get very rich. But of course, that doesn't trickle down. So GDP may look promising, but of course, that GDP isn't equally shared out in the wider population. When you were talking, it reminded me of Imran Khan when he came to the United States when he came to UN General Assembly. And he gave a speech where he said, I was in Shanghai a couple of weeks back, and the streets were immaculate, and you know, the public transport system was amazing, and it looked like a futuristic city. And on my drive here in New York, I was, you know, confronted by potholes, and there were traffic jams, and things were a mess, right? And he was pointing out the inadequacies of America's infrastructure, and it's crumbling services in many ways in comparison to somewhere like China. Now, of course, China has its problems, and certainly Imran Khan, I think, over-egged the China model, to be honest. But nevertheless, I think that's the sort of, this is the stark contrast that people like Donald Trump have been making. Like, we have been fighting these useless conflicts and wars for no apparent reason in the Middle East. Where's the result? And where's where have we reaped in reward from these adventures abroad, right?
Yeah.
And maybe in the 1970s and 80s, you could sort of argue that America's becoming richer as a result of this globalist agenda. Today, I mean, especially since the economic crisis of 2008, Americans have found themselves in a far more economically precarious position. So that's a question lots of Americans are asking. And certainly you asked the question at the beginning, you posed, you know, why is it that Kamala Harris lost? And I think it's a number of factors. I mean, Gaza certainly in the swing states had a major impact, but she lost 10 million votes. And those 10 million votes don't obviously belong to the Muslim community alone or conscientious community. And there are other factors. Social issues were certainly part of it. But I think economic concerns, inflation at the moment is hitting Americans hard. And, you know, especially if you live in rural America or in some of these old Rust Belt states, you know, you're struggling. And it's that old adage, when it comes to winning elections or losing them, it's the economy stupid, right? That's really what counts. So,
Let's look at this factor. The military adventures abroad, for sure, could have reformed so much. Could have reformed so much. Could have brought a lot of prices down for people, too. But there's another element, which is the nature of work and manufacturing. Now, the nature of work and manufacturing, I think that every developing nation eventually sort of graduates itself into a fat consumer that can will no longer do the dirty work or the hard work. And there's a window where that decline is still above the poverty line, but just you're going down. And another country like China is on the way up under that line. So I think that's unavoidable. It's a bad habit that people fall into, but it's unavoidable that you will find any consumer. Why would any manufacturer, any company pay an American factory and have to pay people who want to have SUVs and want to have cable and want to have Netflix and have all these expenses and living at a very high standard relative to the world versus I can go and have that done in another country far cheaper because they're accepting of that. They're accepting of lower standards. Doesn't mean I'm abusing them, but they're just accepting of less money. I don't think it's always abuse. It could be abuse. It could not be abuse, right? Yeah. But I don't think so. I can get, all right, forget all this military adventures and this useless stuff. Let's just focus on ourselves. That I sort of support and I can understand that. But I don't really see the technological and the manufacturing development and changes ever being solved. It's simply the fact that other people are willing to live a simpler life. They're used to living a simpler life, and therefore their labor's cheaper. Your labor's too expensive. So everything is going to be manufactured elsewhere. So whenever economies, nations try to finagle their economy and make it things artificial and force people to just manufacture here, that's not a good practice. So what's your take on the tech and labor element and manufacturing element of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Donald Trump has stated that he believes in trade protectionism. So he wants to put tariffs on almost every product that comes into the United States. Now, of course, he's not going to do that, but he hasn't distinguished. He certainly thinks that China needs its products and its SUVs and its cars need to be subject to trade tariffs. But he also believes that even the European Union have been taken advantage of America's marketplace. Donald Trump, I think, does believe in tariffs. He gave a speech where he said that, you know, tariff is a beautiful word. It's even more beautiful than love. I like tariff is a better word than love, right? So he is a protectionist, and he believes that we shouldn't allow foreign countries to take advantage of our economy. And so here's the logic. The logic is we're offshoring lots of manufacturing in the Far East, for example. So the Americans are offshoring to the Far East. And Chinese companies are then selling their products and flooding their products because they're made cheaply into the American marketplace, right? And because we give them unfettered access to America's marketplace, they can just flood those products, and we're becoming poorer as a result of it. Our workers are losing their jobs, and the products on sale are not made in America. He wants to put an end to that, and he wants, and the way to do that is to have tariffs so that even if Chinese labor is cheaper, even if the labor in you know, the Philippines is cheaper, when they sell those products into America, because of tariffs, those products will become far more expensive. Now, of course, that comes with its own problem because it will make those products more expensive to American consumers, right? Mm-hmm. But I think in Trump's mind, we're feeding China, we're giving China the economic weight in order for China to become a superpower,
yep.
And we have to put an end to that. We have to manage this rising superpower. A lot of Muslims tend to feel that the Americans are obsessed with the Middle East, and certainly, you know, with Gaza, there is a certain obsession with Israel, and that's bipartisan. That's not going to change with Donald Trump, right? But I think on a larger level, Donald Trump just wants to stay out of the Middle East. He would prefer the dictators to run the Middle East as they wish. You know, so he likes Mohammed bin Salman. He likes these other sort of brutal rulers because they keep the population from revolting and from standing from rebelling against their rule. He likes that. But he doesn't really want to get involved in Middle East. I mean, if you remember, one of the reasons why General Mattis resigned was simply because he withdrew troops from or a large number of troops from Syria, because I think he said something like, you know, what the hell are we doing in Syria? Well, just keep the oil. So have troops around the oil fields and the rest of it, you know, let them do it themselves. Let them deal with it themselves. Right. And so, I think there is a philosophy there. The philosophy is that we have to focus on the rise of this superpower, China, and all of our attention needs to be on that country. And Biden has not spent enough time focusing on China's rise. And we have to forget about these other foreign entanglements, especially in the Middle East. And we've got to forget about trying to democratize the Middle East and make it look like us, because that's a fool's errand. And let them continue to do whatever they want between themselves. And back to your question about just sort of the trade disparities between America and the rest of the world. I think that it's interesting. I think that, as I said, I think from Donald Trump's perspective, it's better that large amounts of manufacturing happens in America, onshoring, he calls it, or they call it. And if it can't happen in America, it then happens in states like Mexico, which have agreements with the United States, free trade agreements with the United States, but United States is in control there. You're like, you know, Mexico is not going to threaten America anytime soon, whereas China is going to threaten America sometime soon, right? To the extent that, you know, lots of Americans like Graham Allison are now predicting a war between China and America. And that's very plausible, I think, in the coming few decades.
I mean, who would benefit? Both sides would be severely harmed by it.
They would be. But if you remember, I mean, Graham Allison talks about this in his book, The Thucydides Trap. So he goes back to history and he argues that when you've got an established power and then you've got a rising power, at some stage, that established power is going to become so worried about that rising power that it's either going to have to go to war with it or it's going to have to negotiate a settlement with it. And his argument is that in only four occasions in 2,000 years of history have they ever settled amicably. Wow. In the vast majority of occasions, there's been a war between the rising power and the power that's right. So Germany and Britain, for example, First World War, right? The First World War was a war of empire because Germany was rising and Britain became much more afraid about Germany's rise. And it realized that if it didn't deal with it at that stage, Germany would be just too powerful and Britain could no longer handle its power. And so, yes, it may come to blows, but I think, believe it or not, there are serious people in America who've come to the conclusion that it's now a matter of when, not if, America goes to war with China. Because if we don't do that,
the four times that they were amicable,
I can't remember. I mean, one time was, if I remember right, it was after the Second World War, where Britain, in effect, handed over
power
the
reins
of to America.
Yeah,
and that's because Britain was destroyed.
Yeah,
right. You know, Britain was in a state where it was in no state where it could stand up to America at that stage and say, "No way, are you going to now take over?" In many ways, Britain sort of willingly did that because it saw America as an ideological ally, right? So I can't remember the rest. There were a few other occasions in the 19th century. I remember, I think it was France and Russia. I can't remember any, but we can come back to that. But anyway, his point is, It's possible and plausible that war between China and America will take place. And I think Donald Trump is going to put that focus back on China as he did in his first term.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, by the way, Russia is really interesting here because Donald Trump's view about Russia, by the way, is that Russia should be an ally in our fight against China rather than an adversary. So it's like his view, and again, it tells you something about the philosophy of Donald Trump. And again, I'm not trying to over-egg his thinking here, but I think the people around him certainly, you know, they would like Russia to be on Team America's side, fighting the fight against China in the same way that America was able to woo over China during the Nixon era to its side, so that China and America stood against the Soviet Union. They wanted, it was a policy called triangulation that Kissinger coined and developed in the 1970s, mm-hmm. When they brought China out of the cold. They want to do something very similar with Russia. Mm-hmm. And that's why Putin sort of knows that. And Putin, when Trump was reelected, Putin gave a very conciliatory speech and said that Donald Trump is a wise man, and you know he's a better person than Joe Biden, and that may hint to why Donald Trump wants to end that Ukraine conflict quite quickly as well.
Okay, let's go back to tariffs real quick.
Yeah.
All right, you want to trade in our country? I get that, but usually corporations. Do they pass that tariff price on to the consumer? They're not like paying it out of pocket, then selling us at a competitive price. Aren't they passing it down to the consumer? And as a result of that, so how is the American consumer winning? How is the American citizen benefiting? Yeah. You're harming China. You're making them pay more, but aren't they passing that cost on to the consumer?
That's very true, and again, I was speaking to a brother about this yesterday, who's an economist, and he and that's exactly the question I stated there. And of course, that causes inflation in the short term, because the prices would go up. Now, his argument is that not unless you're willing to readapt your economy mm-hmm. to fill that vacuum, right? So if your economy then can step in and start producing those products, or at least friendly economies can start producing those products, then in the short term there may be a hit, but in the medium to longer term you're able to weather that storm quite well, and I think that's partly what the thinking is, at least of some members around within the some new appointees in the Trump administration. It's fraught with lots of challenges, and you're probably right. In the short term, it's going to be quite harmful to the American consumer. But I feel that for American policymakers now, China is an existential threat. Mm-hmm. Its rise is going to cause a problem. I mean, you've got to listen to John Mersheimer to really appreciate America's policy towards China. I think Mersheimer's on the money. By the way, Mersheimer has been brilliant on Gaza, of course.
He has been.
He's been wonderful on Gaza. But you've got to watch Mersheimer's comments on China and China's rise, because they're really very clever, very smart man. In fact, Mersheimer wrote a book fairly recently about like the folly of liberal America and how it's tried to like export liberal ideals around the world and why that's failed. Mm-hmm. So Mersheimer has called out America for its stupidity over China, but it was also its stupidity in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Like, why would these people want to adopt your values? What mm-hmm. is it? And they're always going to resist your values. And that's just the nature of the differences and the plurality that exists in the world.
Okay, so let's move to another subject that's a big part of the Trump campaign, and that is borders. Mm. So to be honest, on America First, I think that's a common sense position for everybody. Everyone, every nation cares about their own nation first, right? Mm. Borders. Everyone locks their door at night. Why shouldn't the city lock its door at night? Doesn't every nation need some order onto who comes in and who comes out? All right, I get all that. Simultaneously, our tenants here in the soup kitchen, I don't want anyone coming after them. I'm going to put them in the basement. I'm going to hide them. I love them, right? And so I'm sort of personally mixed. I believe in the law and order. There's laws. And how could you just have a nation just Everyone just coming in the border. I also realized that just as I have feelings towards certain people, that I'm going to help them if ICE comes around. And Tom Holland is, this guy is not messing around, right? But I think it's, what is his name? Tom Holman? Whatever his name is, the new guy.
Yeah.
He's not messing around, right?
He's not messing around.
And if I had borders, I would select a guy like that too, right? If I had borders in a nation, I wonder, like, why don't we just put the military down there? What is the military doing, right? What else do they do? Their job is to protect the border. If it's people are coming in, why not just put the military down there, right? Use them. But in any event, the real reality on the ground is that citizens have strong relations with some of these individuals. At the individual level, you can be torn. At the legal level, it's cut and dry. Yeah. To me, it's cut and dry. But at the individual level, you can be torn. As I thought about it today, it's like, yeah, I believe in this law. I would do the same thing if I had a nation, except for so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, right?
Yeah.
Because I know them. I love them. I see them regularly. So let's hear your take on that.
Yeah, you know, I'm somewhat conflicted by what you say there, and I get the point you make. But of course, like from a historical, maybe I'm going too far if I say Islamic, but at least a historical Muslim perspective, mm-hmm. you know, our policy was one of open borders. Of course, the structure of our state for the large swathe of Muslim history were not nation states, small states, but rather empires or caliphates, effectively how we would, or sultanates, as we would coin them. And so, you know, these were in effect large European unions. You could travel from one part to the other and you wouldn't need to have travel documentation, and the currency would be the same, and mm-hmm. You would be able to find a home in every place, and you would have these caravansary places where you could you know, lie down for the night, and it would be provided by the coffers of the Bayt al-Mal. And so, you know, if in modern parlance, Islamic history was one of being very open-minded when it came to borders, because I suppose the Islamic ethic is that the more people experience Islamic societies, the greater they have the propensity to embrace Islam, right? And so it's da'wah to invite non-Muslims into your country and to experience the beauty of Islam. And we see that in a sort of mini sense today when Westerners go to a Muslim country like Afghanistan and expecting it to be, you know, a horrible place, and they come back saying, you know, I think these people are amazing and Islam is a beautiful religion, right? And you see that all the time, you know, on social media. Now, back to your point about Donald Trump's philosophy there. So on one level, we've said that Donald Trump believes in this America first idea when it comes to the world, right? Why get involved in foreign entanglements? Why, all right, America, he believes in protectionism and tariffs when it comes to the economy. And America's economy should not be challenged at the expense of allowing other countries to rise, right? So we've got all of that. But also Donald Trump culturally represents, I think, what is fair to call a nativist strand, right? So some have called it a white nativism, and that may be true or not, but it certainly is a type. He believes in a type of America that is racially at least quite uniform and culturally quite uniform, right? And that impacts the way he views foreigners and the way he views others, and certainly that comes out in his speeches and the way he talks about others. Now, of course, he's got to be very careful in the way he speaks because he doesn't need to offend voters. And surprisingly, Latin American Latinos voted for him in greater number this time round than last time round, right? So he was successful in doing that. But I do believe that Donald Trump believes in this cultural supremacy of Westerners and of white folk. And I think there is that strand there. And we saw that in his first presidency, in the way he viewed, you know, however you view them, the BLM movement, but also the George Floyd murder, you know, horrific murder, the way he viewed the treatment of black people who are treated horrendously sometimes by the police force in various cities. So, you know, I think that it would be wrong to argue that Donald Trump is some savior when it comes to his sort of his cultural views. I mean, mm-hmm. he has got a very closed mind about it. Like, if you were to sit with him and have an honest conversation, I think it wouldn't be surprising to find that he would believe that Europeans are at the top of his hierarchy, and others are you know, maybe less. Are inferior, and so what, you know, does he subscribe to maybe something like a Samuel Huntington idea that you've got these civilizations around the world and they should be kept separate from one another, because once you start intermingling and you start bringing them together, that's when you cause problems? I suspect there is something like that going on in his mind when it comes to others.
But so are you saying that you think that open borders is a better policy than closed borders? Because I think we could look at it as also a harm principle too. It's yeah. one thing that you close your borders from no one to come in. It's another thing to give order to how someone comes in.
Yeah.
So I think that's the middle ground. It's, you can't just have no border at all for a nation. Cause where does it end? If you have no border at all for a nation, then you have no border for the state, then for the town, then for the neighborhood. And then you're going to have, you know, you're going to have some chaotic areas in your nation, and it's going to affect the way people live every yeah. day. And so there's got to be that middle ground, has to be that we're going to allow in this number of people. And then there are temporary visas, there are whatever. And I think that every nation has their own order of this. So, you know, that's more likely to be the right way to have, if you want to have open borders and you just want to be interacting with the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's got to be some kind of order to it.
No doubt. And one needs to manage that intake. And of course, when we think about modern economies, demography really matters. Mm-hmm. So if you think about across Europe at the moment, the average age is going up year on year. And so we're now reaching sort of 30, 40 average age. And that's a problem for economies. I mean, Britain, for example, has a major problem because of Brexit. Mm-hmm. We no longer have members from Poland and Romania easily coming into the UK, and it's a far more difficult process mm-hmm. to come into the UK. And so a lot of those jobs that these people were filling are no longer they're no longer able to find workers. So, for example, the building trade in Britain, you know, plumbing and these sort of basic services are now suffering as a result of too few laborers. So you do need to have a steady flow of labor. And of course, those who are coming from Latin America are working age, right? And so they are going to fill those jobs Americans require. I agree. I mean, I think any nation state, will need to have managed borders. All I'm trying to indicate here is that Donald Trump, I think, there's a cultural philosophy around that,
yeah,
which I think we shouldn't discount. And I think you and I see it in his speeches and the way he talks about others.
Okay. Let's talk about the same subject from a different angle. I always debate this subject. Nations do well when their people are unified. People are unified when they share a culture. Simultaneously, a diverse nation is very strong too, because it has a lot of different perspectives. Where is the tipping point where excess of cultural difference ends up actually making everybody unhappy, and everyone's disunited? Nobody really shares any culture with anyone. And most of us grew up in a time where the only time that there is any cultural unity is, you know, small pockets of MSA, PSA, Masajid, little institutions, organizations. So most of us have never tasted it. But when I imagine a successful group, they're unified because they share the same ideas. They share the same culture. So I actually appreciate that point of things. But you also have power and diversity. where is the line? Where is the balance? How do we come to that? You have any ever thought about this?
Yeah, I have thought about it because it goes into the conversation about models of multiculturalism. And I used to teach this when I used to teach politics. So there are a number of philosophies or thoughts about how do you build diverse societies. And so the dominant strand are what we call the liberal multiculturalists. So you've got people like Will Kimlicker, who's a Canadian, who coined or developed this idea of liberal multiculturalism. And the idea is as follows, and it actually is very similar to that Fukuyama, that sort of liberal hubris, that arrogance that you talked about earlier. So the idea is as follows: in order to build a diverse society, if you've got a Pakistani coming in or a Bengali coming in or a Indian coming into your country, you've got to embrace them with open arms. So, you know, if they come in through a managed process, you've got to embrace them. You don't show hostility towards them. But the idea behind liberal multiculturalism is that as they come into the country and they realize that they've got to get by in that country, they've got to work, they've got to integrate, you're going to start negotiating values. And so within time, if it's not the first generation, but certainly the second generation are going to still be Muslim or still be Hindu or still be Sikh or still be whatever, right? Buddhist or whatever it may be. But in that process of integrating, they're going to have to adopt some of the thick values of liberalism and embrace those values of liberalism so that they can integrate. And so in the liberal universe, diversity is okay because diversity leads to everyone being good little liberals.
Well,
right?
it's just a superficial diversity.
It's a superficial diversity. And that's actually what someone like Bhikkhu Parikh, who is a different type of multiculturalist, he's what we call a pluralist multiculturalist. Bhikkhu Parikh argues it's superficial diversity. Like what you really want, so he basically says to the liberals that you believe in a liberal supremacy and you're hiding behind these fancy terms, right? Like you want everyone to be liberals and then you claim, I still want them to be a Muslim or a Hindu. In reality, you want them to adopt your religion. And Bhikkhu Parikh, I think, is really interesting. He's a Hindu, he's a Lord here in the House of Lords, but I interviewed him on my program. And he's a very interesting guy because he argues, look, if you really believe in diversity, you've got to believe in deep diversity. So you're going to have to accept there are some communities that will have radically different values to you. If you invite them into your country, don't expect them to change radically. You're going to have to find a way to deal with them and to accept that diversity, right? And to find a way in which you're going to find commonalities between you without diluting what you believe in. Now, how realistic is that? Is your point? Like, how realistic is it to have diverse societies where we have stark differences? Well, I suppose historically, like the Islamic model was that we never really expected other communities, unless they willingly embrace Islam, we never expected other communities to give up things for the sake of being part of the Muslim polity, right? And so the Islamic standard generally was that Muslim states would allow communities to establish what today they would call ghettos, establish their own sub-community groups, right? So the Jews would have their subgroups and, you know, the Magians would have their subgroups and all of these communities. And they would live in those communities almost like uniformly in those subgroups because Islam didn't meddle with their religious affairs, whereas liberalism meddles in our religious affairs. Yeah. Liberalism says to us that we need to teach all of our kids, you know, a particular social agenda, right? Whereas, you know, the Islamic model was to let them remain as they are and let them be as they are. Yeah. And as long as they didn't interfere with the public law, so some of the sort of standards of public law, then Islam gave a great amount of plurality. In fact, Islam was far more pluralistic than any liberal state today.
Yeah. And the sign of pluralism is that you have multiple court systems.
Yeah.
And that's what the millet system, milletist community, the millet system had in the Ottoman Empire, and I'm sure before that too, they had the same idea where Jewish communities had their own courts, and they even had their own, they gave their own punishments, had their own judges, as long as it was within that community, Christians within their community. And then once you entered in the public, like you said, then you're going to the Sharia court after that. So that's where I think that people are, that's a great answer, the idea that diversity is not actually a real diversity. It's essentially just melting the beliefs into one, and only the faces on the outside are diverse. But in the United States, I'm starting to see, well, everyone is starting to see, the left and right actually have different beliefs about reality itself. Like, and that's why the divide between them is bigger than it's ever been before. Because it's not just, should there be big government, small government, but our identity is one. No, they actually believe total different things about existence, about the universe, about truth, about words, about the meaning of everything. They're so disparate. The only thing they agree on is Israel, right? Who's funding both sides, of course, as usual.
Yeah.
But I wanna talk about this. Someone here is asking, what is a more direct answer to the border question? No, my answer to the border question is, my personal opinion on it is, you have to have a border. If people want to come in, they got to come in on your process, right? On the conditions that you set. I mean, just think about it as a home. I could have people come into my home on my terms, right? And just work your way outward, right? Everything's going to be on your terms. You want to come in, you want to do business in the state of New Jersey, on the state of New Jersey's terms. You're going to follow their permits, et cetera. You want to come into a nation, you got to come in on their terms. It can't just be an empty. Then what's the point of having two different? Then make Mexico and U.S. Just a 51st state of the United States, right? Mm. So point being is that we're talking about diversity and borders. There has to be a process, but the real dilemma is what happens with people who have been here for a long time, and now we're going to go and we've let things happen, and we let things people move and have families and have connections here, and now we want to act upon the law that we've been turning a blind eye to and deport everybody, right? That's where the human side is going to conflict with your legal side, because legally, yeah, okay, you're illegal, so you should be deported. I get that, but there are so many human sides to it, and I thought about this coming in today. I thought, you know what, if these guys downstairs, they ever come for the guys downstairs, right? Well, although I get the law, I'm gonna the way I reconciled it is, I agree with the law. The law is the law, but I'm gonna give these guys a chance. I'm gonna help them out. I'm gonna put them in the basement. I'm gonna put them somewhere to give them a chance, right? To survive this type of thing. But so that's the question that we have to ask.
Yeah.
What would you do? If you ruled, what would you do?
No, I'm a little different to you, Hiver. I just feel that America, and maybe this is my time to sort of to place my politics very squarely on the table. I mean, I think America has destroyed so many countries, and has caused so much bloodshed and misery around the world. And then when these Afghans or when these Mexicans want to come to America. I mean, Mexico used to have a thriving agricultural economy until NAFTA, until the North American Free Trade Association was signed, and that flooded the American marketplace with industrialized agriculture coming from Canada and the USA. And today, agriculture in Mexico is very specialist. It's like avocados. It's things that only Mexico can grow well, and those agricultural workers then had to move to the cities to work in poorer jobs in Ford companies, in Ford manufacturing units, in order for and that dislocated families, and that destroyed sort of those family units for centuries that used to live on the farm and used to live together. They were now dislocated, and then when those jobs became more scarce, these young people then had to try their best to go to the United States to work in any job in order to make their way and send remittances back home. And so now you've got, you know, a mother who living in you know, California or in Texas, whose daughter, a young daughter, is living in Mexico with their grandfather or grandmother. And it's a sad tale of just the total misery of this economic order that America has created in the world, right? So I don't. I you know, I'm from the outside, right? So I'm a Brit here talking about America, but I don't have very much sympathy for the American state who's putting up the borders, largely because of the type of economic and military order it's created in the world that has harmed large numbers of people.
100%. You're 100% right about that. We can't discount that. And the way I look at it is that if a person has made his way in a time where you didn't observe your own border, right, and they've made their way and they could get testimony from people, you got to give them some kind of, because they've contributed, right? Yeah. Give them some kind of leeway. If you've been here, let's say, I would say you've been here 2 years. All right, fine. Deport. But you've been here 3 and 4 years and 5 years and 6 years, and you got a family, your kids go to school, you're a worker, you haven't broken any laws, you have people who could testify that you're a contributor to the nation in some way. Like, there's got to be a system like that. Now, it would take a long time, right? And maybe you do the first thing first is seal off your border. People want to come in, they come in legally. Then a few years, put a number on that. 2-3 years or something. Let's say 3 years. 3 years, you're going to be out. Okay. 3 years, you haven't had a chance to really completely transform your life. But you've been here more than 3 years. Now we break it up. No crimes? All right, let's talk. Crimes? Go back. 3 years and no crimes. Now let's talk. These people, give them a chance. If they can show some kind of proof that they're contributing to society, now give them a form of paperwork, right? That where they let them live, right? Because they benefited, and it's not their fault that you A, destroyed their economies, B, you weren't looking at your own border, right? Now you can't come now and try to rip the Band-Aid off after it's been on for so long. So, well, that's my take on it. I want to ask you about something you said earlier about labor. You said that when England closed their door on the Polish and the Ukrainians, plumbing went down and painting went down and construction went down, and you had problems with that, right? I think that's a good thing, because if your populace has gotten so lazy and they're not good at doing this stuff, let those industries suffer a little bit. At some point, some people within the nation will say, all right, let's get to work, right? If we were to, and think about this at a micro level, because I like to look at things at a micro level, and a lot of times, not all times, you can expand it. At a micro level, if a family has a cleaning lady, the house is clean. But we've also developed very lazy habits because we know she's coming, right? Then one day, she doesn't come anymore. We're all going to whine and complain, but guess what? It's going to get so bad that we're all going to say, we're going to get to the point, we got to reform ourselves. We got to get better, right? And we've got to start cleaning ourselves. So it actually helps a nation instead of them just relying on a crutch.
Yeah, possibly true. But of course, another factor in this is just basic demography, aging populations, right? So Europe is now the oldest continent in the world. The average age of Europeans is now nearing, by 2030, they're saying that the average age of North Americans and Europeans will be 40 or above, whereas the average age of the African by 2030 will be around 20, or just around 20 years old, right? Amazing. And that's a really big difference in demography. And that's a ticking time bomb, because, of course, you'll have too few workers at the bottom. And, of course, the way it works is that the younger your workforce, the more productive they are. Yep. So you're destroying your productivity because of your demography. Now, we know why there is that demographic time bomb, because, of course, liberalism and urbanization that comes out of capitalism creates a type of society where people do not want to have children. And, you know, it's a type of middle class lifestyle that leads to this sort of thinking that children are going to impact our lifestyle. And of course, we as Muslims, we know very clearly that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala provides rizq, and having children is not going to encroach on your rizq quite the opposite, actually, sometimes, right? Yep. You know, I know a brother here who has to have a van to ship around his family, like a literal van.
He's going to be a happy old man when he gets old.
And, you know, he said to me the other day,
little grandkids.
Yeah, yeah. He said to me the other day, you know, that every time I had another child, my wife had another child, you know, subhanAllah, I got a better job offer, or my wage went up, right? So, you know, he was a living example of someone who, you know, was not worried about his risk, but actually cared more about these wider social issues. Now, yeah. Europe isn't like that. Europe and North America are now, as they get richer, they're having fewer kids. And so the only way then to deal with it is through foreign labor. It's actually to get foreign labor from outside. Britain needs that. Britain is desperate. At the moment, in Britain, we've got a real problem with some trades because of the lack of labor from outside. And remember, a lot of the Eastern European states remain Catholic states, and so they do have a greater number of children.
Yep.
And that was providing for these medium or low-end jobs in the UK. So, you know, demography really matters. Now, of course, the West in its hubris believe that the way they're going to buck that trend is through AI. If you can find, you know, for a long time, there's never been a machine that could pick fruit. Yeah. Because fruit is so soft. And of course, you just need to have human beings to do it. And it's very difficult. Now you're beginning to see machines that may be able to pick fruit. Well, can pick fruit using, you know, AI technology and various forms of tech. So the idea is that you're not going to need cab drivers in the future and lorry drivers, because this will all be automated, you know, vehicles. So in their arrogance, they think that their scientific advancement is going to buck that trend, right? But it's still, I think that's not going to fully solve the problem, and it's still going to be a major problem for them. So yeah, back to your question, I'm not convinced, or I'm not sure that alone is going to solve the problem. And also the other problem, by the way, is there was a great documentary on TV I watched once here in the UK, where they just did that, like a farmer invited British teenagers along to pick fruit and to do basic farming activity. And so the kids will come along within a day or two, they'll be absent. I'm ill. I can't do this.
Yep.
Because they suffer from, laziness. From laziness, spoiled. Right?
Yep.
Exactly. And that's very hard. That cultural shift, that cultural change is very hard to, whereas, you know, a Romanian worker that comes to Britain, you know, is going to see the value of that work. And of course, even if they're getting paid relatively to the rest of the Brits less, that money is going to do very well for them in remittances back home. And that you can see the same for Mexicans and others who come to America.
I think it's a problem people created for themselves when they live in a certain way where your population decreases. Clearly there is something terribly wrong with how you live as a nation, right? That's the first result of success, is to have people, that you produce people. All right. So let's go to another topic. We talked about America first. We talked about borders and labor. Very good topic, and we're holding you for a long time, but that's okay because people love you here. And we have a lot of viewers here. Probably one of the most we've ever had, to be honest, live viewers. They love these political talks, and the British, you're representing them because they keep saying, oh, Muhammad Jalal from England representing us. We love him.
It's the accent. That's what
it must be. It must be. They've never heard so much intelligence on the live stream before because of the accent. We have to talk. We cannot not address Trump, address Trump and ignore his Zionism on one hand, but is also racism and xenophobia from him, that the signals he gives out to his people, and is definitely that's the world order that he wants to live in and surrounds himself with that. So the new racist is a Zionist, whereas the old racist, the old Nazi hated Jews, was an anti-Semite, but the new type of racist is a Zionist as well. So tell us about that a little bit. I mean, you're not here, but I can definitely tell you that Muslim women feel it, complain about it, because they get targeted. Hispanic looking people get targeted. And when I say get targeted, I mean by people who are just hooligans talking in supermarkets and bullying people who they could feel that can't defend themselves. So tell us a little bit about what you know about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I wrote a couple of pieces a while back about these very disturbing strands that are developing in America. And I tried to link it to a response to liberalism. So what you're finding in the United States, and actually in large parts of the world, I mean, Europe is where we're now seeing the rise of right-wing parties who are extremely Islamophobic and extremely xenophobic, right? So it's a development across the West, and it's a development that comes out the inadequacies of the liberal capitalist system. You know, the system has failed large swathes of Brits, of French people, of Germans, of Americans, and because it's failed for so long, the response to that is to blame foreigners, and that's really what you're seeing playing out across these countries. And Donald Trump reflects that antagonism, because Donald Trump is a populist, they say, and you know, I wrote a piece in when Biden gave the day of his inauguration. And I think I titled it "The Uncivil War That Splits America." And I'm going to revise that article because I think the point I was trying to make there is that there is this split in the United States, and it's on a number of levels, and it comes from a recognition that the system is now failing them. Right. So for so long, the system was working okay, and everyone was gaining something from that system. The system now is failing economically. Americans are worse off. They're working two or three jobs sometimes to make ends meet.
Yeah.
This is not a system that is working for the ordinary American, right? It's working for the elites, of course, but it's not working for the ordinary person. Mm-hmm. And so the response to that is to go back to this white nativism, this cultural supremacy, this sort of idea that we are better than them, so why are they taking our jobs? We're better than them, so why is this guy driving a BMW? And, you know, we have to make do with our old rusty car, right? So it is that acknowledgement that others, or that belief or that perception that others are doing better out of this system. And of course, the Proud Boys and the sort of racialized units in America, they believe in the Great Replacement Theory.
Yeah.
And the Great Replacement Theory is this idea that liberal America has purposely allowed in migration in order for those migrants to become voters, critical voters, who will continue to vote for the Democrats and the Labour Party and, you know, the left-leaning parties, the progressive parties across the West. And the idea then is that they would reward those people who have allowed them into the country, and those people who have allowed them, those governments would give them preferential housing and preferential jobs and preferential. This is not my argument. It's the argument of the Great Replacement Theory, and so the blame then is on these liberal elites who effectively have sewn up a system that is against the original in inverted commas white inhabitant of the United States or across Europe, right? And believe it or not, large swathes of white America and white Europeans believe this idea now. I mean, the New Zealand mosque shooter, he wrote a manifesto where he explicitly talked about this. And I remember reading it, and I wrote something about it for, I think it was for Muslim Matters or one of these, I think it's for Traversing Tradition, American online magazine, where he said that, you know, he traveled around Europe, and what he saw was effectively this phenomenon, right, of foreigners being given preferential treatment by liberal elites. Now, of course, that's nonsense, right? Because if anything, you know, we face discrimination on a daily basis, and to get by, you know, Muslims have to work twice as hard sometimes to get by at work and to be recognized, and Africans are the same, and you know, if you go to France and, you know, subhanAllah, you have to be, you need to be aware of the situation of Muslims in France. I mean, they're treated as fourth-class citizens. It's that parlous for them.
Okay, so I want to bring a different angle to this. We have to have a sense of pride, every single one of us. And sometimes I'm always in the minority in this view. But tell me what you think about this. I don't care at all what anyone thinks or how they treat me. And I also think about, let's say Muslims in France. I would blame myself for going to a land of crusaders. I'm not blaming the French Muslims, but this is my pattern of thinking, right? If I find myself as a, let's say, an Algerian in France, and I'm not getting treated that nicely, right? I have to ask myself the question, what does a history book say? And what in the world do I expect? Why would I expect these people who did all these other things to treat me well? That doesn't make any sense. I expect them. I'm even surprised they let me in the country, right? So my attitude is, I actually expect the worst from people who have behaved badly, right? The Americans brought in slavery. They mistreated every nation that they've went to. They genocided the Native Americans. So I expect bad behavior from them. I don't expect them to treat me nicely on one hand. Number two, I'll never, ever ask you to treat me well. If I need something, I'll work it out myself, or I'll leave, right? I'll either work it out myself, I'll get tough and I'll work it out myself, I'll make money myself. If you're not going to treat me well in the company, to hell with your company, right? I'm not going to come and beg from you to treat me well in the company. I'll go to another company. You see that sense of, we have to have a sense of pride, but and at the same time, a sense of history, of expectation. I would be hurt if other Muslims didn't treat me well, because we have a deen. Nonetheless, I'm not asking you to treat me well or to like me or to be my friend or buddy or anything. I'm going to move on real fast. What do you think of this take towards racism and xenophobia?
Yeah, I agree to it to an extent, right? And of course, you have your personal autonomy, and you have a responsibility to do your best and to prove them wrong. So certainly that's true. In the same way, for example, you may be a student at school and you face all sorts of discrimination, but you still work hard and you make sure that, you know, you're attentive to your studies and you do well in your exams, right? So, you know, that's in a way proving them wrong, but also it's a sense of resilience that you personally have and that your family have inculcated, and many, alhamdulillah, many Muslims and many foreigners have that when they go to foreign lands. It's not as if they go to these countries expecting milk and honey, but, you know, quite the opposite. Actually, they expect racism, they expect xenophobia. So in a sense, I agree with that. And I certainly agree that, you know, we shouldn't sort of just have a complaining culture, right, where we point that out and not feel a sense of responsibility ourselves. But at the same time, and maybe it's hard for someone in America to feel this, because in America, in many ways, the system still remains fair. Now, I'm going to put that in inverted commas, because you've got a constitution and you've got these rights that come out of the Bill of Rights. And it's the system, even though the system is very much weighted against us sometimes, you know, especially after 9/11. But the system generally, it promotes a sense of fairness, and that maybe talks to an American experience, right? Whereas in Europe, the system just works against you. If you're in France, you know, your hijab is banned. So, you know, as soon as a Muslim girl wants to wear hijab in school, university is banned. They're treated, you know, culturally inferior. I remember there was this occasion where a Muslim African, there was a young man who was sort of a young boy who was hanging by his fingertips off a windowsill. He climbed out and he was about to fall. So this African migrant, recent migrant, I think he was from Cameroon or something, he's a Muslim. he was known as a Spider-Man. He climbed up the building and saved his kid. And, you know, and Macron at the time, he was saying all sorts of xenophobic comments and anti and Islamophobic comments, invited him in and gave him the Medal of Honor. You know, you've saved a French citizen. And he said, you know, I'm going to make you a French citizen, even though you aren't, because in a way you've shown that you are more French than we are. Like you've proven your Frenchness, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the guy outside, when he was given a speech and he was asked, why did you do this? It's because I'm an African, I'm a Muslim, and it's part of my religion and culture to save people, right? So in his mind, it's Islam, it's his African roots that brought him to this place, right? But mm-hmm. from the French deny that completely. For them, that's like that's barbarism. You know, Islam is a barbaric backward faith. And the way they malign Islam, I mean, you know, you may have come across this today now in France, they are expunging French imams. Mm-hmm. They're expelling them from the country. There was a French imam who read out the prophet's last sermon.
Yeah.
In one of his khutbahs, and he was thrown out of the country, because in that khutbah it says something about men and women, and it was translated as being anti-equality, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think what I'm trying to say is that systemically,
yeah,
you know, institutionally in some of these countries, it works against you.
Yep.
So then personal autonomy has very little part to play. You could try your best individually, but the system is harming you. It's working 100%.
And maybe I should have started by saying that the default relationship here is adversarial.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
We have to start with that. The default. So here we are as a minority in a nation, and the default is not a friendly relationship. Right? This is an adversarial. So for me to expect otherwise is silly, right? And for me to beg for otherwise, totally, you know.
But I accept that, Sheikh Shadi. But I think then what we're lulled into a false sense of security, because of course, when we come here, we hear these great words about how liberal democracies embrace diversity. Right. Mm-hmm. And we hear these great words about equality. And we feel that these societies ideologically have moved on and they now embrace the other. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's only when I met, for example, a very leading journalist from the Times newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, in Britain, it's a very prestigious, old, one of the most established papers in the UK, if not the world. And a Muslim woman. And, you know, she said to me that, you know, I used to believe that. I thought, you know, we could all make it. But then when she wrote an article about France and about the hijab, all hell broke loose. Mm-hmm. She was working for the Financial Times at the time, I should say. And her article was removed, and then Macron replaced it with his own op-ed. And it was like, and that's because she had the audacity to point out that the French secularism is harming Muslims, right? It was a very well-written article. And she said that from that point on, I realized it's not an equal playing field. Oh. You know, all of these lovely words that they give us about liberalism and about plurality and about equality, none of it means anything when it comes nothing. To Islam and Muslims and your values.
Yeah. It means nothing. And whenever I see like any Muslim who is say sort of using civil rights language,
yeah,
whether it's in France, England, America, I'm just wondering, like, do you read history? You just stepped into this thing without any sense of context at all, and you look really stupid, and you're going to fail and be really disappointed. Let's not forget who established these nations, and for whom did they establish these nations? Establish this nation for themselves. As soon as things start not suiting them anymore, right? To heck with all the laws that they made.